13-18-614-CR, Eloy Iraclio Alcala versus State of Texas.
May it please the court, Mr. Devino, thank you for granting oral argument on this case. Before I get started, I'd like to use 1 minute of my time to explain to the court that personally, this was a difficult brief for me to write. It was very fact-intensive, and it was a lot of record references with a huge record that was difficult. And in my preparation for this oral argument, to my dismay, I saw that there was some record reference errors. So, including but not limited to, basically what I did was all the record references dealing with the factual disputes for purposes of arguing 3823, I put those into the statement of the case to try to lower the word count in the body of the brief. And there were about 6 pages of record references that were completely omitted at the end of the statement of the case. So, I'm asking leave of court to be able to file a supplemental brief, not changing the substance of the brief, but mainly to correct the record references and to add in those 6 pages of record references at the very end of the statement of the case. And I could do that by Friday of next week. And of course, Mr. Devino, I would have no objection to him responding to it if he felt like it was necessary. But I'm just throwing that out to you at this moment so that you can maybe consider that and give me an answer by the end of the oral argument today, hopefully.
I don't think the court has a problem with giving you a week to submit that correction. Then, Mr. Devino, of course, anything you'd like to respond to within the scope and course of what she submits in another week?
Thank you, Your Honor. So I'm going to start off with issue 7, which has to do with the motion to suppress. Front and center in this issue has to do with the supposed criminal trespass by the police. And many of the issues considered in the motion to suppress are also relevant in the 3823 issue, which is issue 8 of the brief. However, the evidence is different. In the motion to suppress, we're required to only look at the evidence submitted in the motion to suppress hearing. And of course, in the trial, we're only allowed to look at the evidence submitted at the trial. So the underlying factor in deciding this motion to suppress is, you know, deciding whether consent existed, implied consent, meaning the knock and talk, plain view, exigent circumstances, which includes the existence of probable cause, and police conduct, which is misconduct, which is the trespass issue. So I'm going to start with plain view doctrine and the consent issues as well as all other sub-issues of the Fourth Amendment exceptions that the state uses to excuse the warrantless entry into Mr. Alcala's property and home. And the state concedes in its first brief on page 14 that the police entered without a warrant, so it was a warrantless entry. So the next question is whether any of the exceptions to the Fourth Amendment, searches and seizure amendment of the Constitution exist. And Mr. Alcala submits that motion to suppress should have been granted. One's home is sacrosanct. Each person has the right to be secure in the home. That's you, me, Mr. Devino, everybody. And the basic requirement is that a warrant is necessary. But a warrant never issued here, even though the evidence at trial and maybe at the motion to suppress was that there was much radio chatter among the policemen that a warrant was needed. And that's a consistent fact throughout the whole case. Instead, the police had to commit criminal trespass in order to find probable cause.
Counsel, are you talking about them entering the property itself? Because it appears from the record that that your client did invite them into the home. But are you talking about just entering into the premises?
There are two occasions when the criminal trespass occurred. Number one, initially, when they went into the property to feel the hood of the truck as to the temperature of the truck, the hood, to see if it had been recently driven. Number two, while they were in there, they saw plain view blood in the Cadillac. And number three, they saw a bullet casing in the console of the truck at issue. Those latter two things were found under the plain view doctrine, according to the police testimony. The second criminal trespass occurred when they went into the property to knock on the door and talk to Mr. Alcala, at which point he supposedly consented, although we argue that the consent was not voluntary. So,
let me ask you that, and maybe you can address it either in your current brief or in your brief that you will be filing. But where in the record where is it proven, basically, or testimony about whether he was expressly or impliedly coerced into signing?
Okay,
because he signed the consent form.
Right.
So we have that in the evidence. Clearly, but where in the, if you would point to the record, either in your current brief or your supplemental brief you intend to supplement, as to where that would, it proves your argument that he was expressly or impliedly coerced.
Yes, Your Honor. There is an item of evidence in there is an affidavit that was admitted into evidence in the motion to suppress. And that affidavit is taken as evidence in the hearing on the motion to suppress. Now that was not admitted at trial, and Mr. Alcala did not testify at trial. So for purposes of the motion to suppress, he testified in that affidavit, and I can give you the record reference in just a few minutes. I did not write it down.
That's fine, counsel. You can come back.
So in general, Your Honor, his affidavit, which is his written testimony, was that he saw SWAT team members. There were several officers with guns drawn. Okay, there were many officers surrounding his property. He had already seen them even before they trespassed onto his property to knock on the door. So all of that implies that this was not a voluntary consent. He stated that because the officers had already gone into his property, he'd seen it through the window, he felt like he had no choice but to consent. It was not a voluntary consent. But more importantly, the court really should be looking at the idea that when you go and knock and talk, and you knock on a door for purposes of talking, the law requires that you have to be legally present on the property, okay? The law requires that if you are going to seek consent, you have to legally be present on the property. When you trespass onto the property to get that, you're breaking the law, okay? You're breaking the law, which is the 30.05 of the Texas Penal Code, criminal trespass. And the evidence is also clear in the motion to suppress and at trial that the entire house was enclosed by a fence, okay? And that fence had a gate. And that fence also had a sliding gate. Both were closed. There was no indication that the public had a right to go in there, including the police, especially at 2 a.m, okay? So the statute specifically states that when you have a house that's enclosed by a fence, that is notice to the public that they are not welcome into the premises. And I would add, Your Honor, that the area that we're talking about, the truck, the Cadillac, that's considered the curtilage of the house, which is well established, is still encompassed as a part of the sacrosanct, sacred homestead of the home. So it is also enjoys the protection of the Fourth Amendment. So, also at issue in this case are the exigent circumstances. There are three categories identified by the case law, rendering aid who the officers reasonably believe are in need of assistance, and that I think that's also been called the emergency doctrine. preventing imminent destruction of evidence or contraband, that's more commonly seen in drug cases where someone's going to quickly flush cocaine down the toilet, protecting the officers from persons whom they reason believe to be present, armed, and dangerous. So,
counsel,
yes.
What are the factual issues that you believe the jury should have been presented with through the Article 38.23 instruction? The law requires some affirmative presentation of evidence. What affirmative presentation did Akala make?
Okay, so that's what is in my statement of the case. And I can get that to you right now. If you want me to jump over to that, because that was going to be my next thing to argue. So the factual issues, there's no contest. Okay, this is what's a, kind of a dilemma. Both the state and the defense agree that the police entered into the property without a warrant, okay? The defendant calls that criminal trespass. Notice was given to the public that they weren't welcome into the property. The state says, no, it's not criminal trespass because there's exigent circumstances. So that's where the fact issues lie, is in the issue of exigent circumstances and the consent issue, okay? So even though the state says, well, there was an unlocked lock on the gate, that's an attempt to create a new exception, but the law doesn't say anything about lock. All it requires is the fence, and that's it, okay? So going on to the fact issues that you're talking about or asking about, Justice Silva, is that, and this is the part that was very fact-intensive. We have evidence that exigent circumstances existed, located on page 33, little I, 33 I pages of the statement of the case. There's testimony by the state that there was, there may have been a problem with immediate destruction of evidence. That there was an emergency providing aid, and I have all those record references, protection of officers and others, and this is in the motion to suppress hearing. Officer Quilantan testified that the reason he made entry, and he actually admitted to it, he said it was for exigent circumstances. We just had a double homicide, and people were pointing out there to the specific reason. So the reason I wanted to get in there was to touch the hood. Okay, he admitted that the reason he wanted to get in there was to get evidence. I want to commit criminal trespass to get evidence. There's nothing more illegal than that.
Wasn't he saying, though, Counselor, that he wanted to, there were exigent circumstances because if he didn't go and touch the hood right away, he wouldn't know whether or not it was warm.
Right.
And so and that would be a loss of evidence.
And there is evidence, there is a case I cited in my brief, Your Honor, that had to do with blood draw, all right? So
the Virial case.
Pardon me?
The Virial case. Yeah.
Well, that might have been it. I think I cited to a different case in my brief, but it had to do with when the dissipation of alcohol level in the blood occurs by passing of time, that is not exigent circumstances. You have to go get a warrant. And just like here, they had been taught from the beginning, radio chatter, get a warrant, get a warrant, get a warrant. And that's all they needed to do, okay? And the hood of the truck, that it's warm, how does that play into whether or not Mr. Akala committed capital murder, either directly or as a party? You see, two other vehicles had been approached in the vicinity regarding the, because they were looking for a white Dodge Ram, because they found two other Dodge Rams. And they went to those houses, and in each house they attempted to get permission to enter into the property. They talked to the owners of the homes. They didn't do that with Mr. Akala. He just walks in his free will and touches the hood of the car. And then in plain view, while he's in there, he sees the blood and he sees the casing. Okay? The underlying premise here, and the most important thing to consider, is that this was criminal trespass. There was no warrant, and there's no exigent circumstances. And getting back to Justice Silva's question, Officer Galaviz testified they were looking for an active shooter who was still in the area, and they wanted to make sure the actual shooter was not in the property or inside the vehicle. So those were what I saw to be the record references supporting exigent circumstances. But the defense was able to elicit from the witnesses, and I just want to sort of sidestep the issue a little bit, in that the state argued at the charge conference that you can't elicit this testimony from a state witness. And I'm not sure exactly what Mr. Morris meant by that, but I think what he was saying is your questions it's not evidence. The defense questions is not evidence. But if you're eliciting testimony, that's evidence. And if you're eliciting testimony that's contrary to what's already been established, that's evidence. And that's a fact issue. And that can exist in this situation. But getting back to Justice Silva's question, evidence that exigent circumstances do not exist is that Officer Luengo did not see any illegal activity taking place around the truck while it was parked at Mr. Alcala's property. He saw no one in the Cadillac. He did not see any blood from outside the fence prior to his initial trespass. Officer Quilantan did not see any criminal activity at the moment while standing outside the fence. He did not see any drug activity occurring. Officer Quilantan did not see a gun, nor did he see anyone at or around near the truck. From outside the fence, Officer Quilantan trespassed upon Mr. Alcala's property. He shined his light in the Cadillac where blood was found, and prior to that, he had not seen the blood, nor had there been any illegal activity. He did not see shadows at the window prior to initially trespassing, and he did not hear movements prior to initially trespassing. So that's one. Then the existence of probable cause is necessary, okay, to establish exigent circumstances. You know, the state really harped on, we saw shadows at the windows, or we heard a lock of the door. That's not even reasonable suspicion to raise the issue of exigent circumstances. It certainly would fail in the issuance of a probable cause warrant, and Mr. Alcala submits that the reason why they criminally trespass is they were so desperate to get that warrant because there was no probable cause to pin Mr. Alcala to the crime. Okay? They were doing sort of what I would call an upside down probable cause. Okay? Let's do it upside down. Let's go get consent so that everything we've done illegal so far can work. And so that the court can use that to convict. So as to the existence of probable cause, all of that is stated in my brief on pages 35, 36, 37, and these are I pages, 38, 39, 40, 41. So I'm looking at XLI. I'm not sure what that is in Roman numerals, XLI. But when I get to XLII, that's evidence that no probable cause existed, the second prong in the inquiry of whether exigent circumstances exist. Okay, so initially when the police first started investigating, the suspect vehicle was initially gray, okay? There had been several witnesses, not just one, but several witnesses that identified a gray vehicle. Sometime during the initial investigation, the color of the vehicle changed from gray to white. And then, and most importantly, 48 seconds, okay. The trial court sustained the state's objection on several occasions that prevented the defendant from asking questions of the officers that would help create the factual issue. So for that, I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to let this turn
it
over.
Before you leave, let me just ask you the question. Uh-huh. Being that the court did stop that line of questioning when the objection was made as argumentative from the state, So basically, are you acknowledging that the court is, should review this ruling under an abuse of discretion?
Well, on a motion to suppress, that is the standard, abuse of discretion.
Okay. And also, the question that I have is, you know, you're also arguing that the fact that they didn't allow this cross-examination violated Alcala's constitutional rights of confrontation. Was that raised by trial counsel at trial?
It was.
It was?
Yes.
Not in the motion to suppress.
No, at trial he made objections. And as to the state's objection, so I'm entitled to cross-examine, Your Honor, asked and answered. I mean, the judge seemed to think that once it's asked on direct, you shouldn't have to ask it on cross, but that's entirely wrong.
But it was, he didn't specifically say.
No, and you're right, Your Honor. He didn't specifically say that. But it seemed to be that's the way he was operating. And I just feel like in cross-examination, it's wide open, and the defendant has a right to elicit bias, to cross-examine, to impeach, and his hands were tied. On many occasions, many of which pertain to these factual issues as to whether or not exigent circumstances existed.
Okay, counsel, you've answered my question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sorry about all the paperwork I have.
It is very, the record is intense.
Yes.
Mr. Devineau?
Thank you, Madam Justice. May it please the court, Ms. Carroll. Thank you, first off, for allowing us in a little bit of extra time to argue, because this is a voluminous case, and respectfully, the brief from appellant was 181 pages. It took some time to work through. Preliminarily, the court's well aware this is a retrial. The case has been up and back again for retrial. He was convicted the second time. The first reversal was based on an invocation of rights. This honorable court found that a phrase, something like, yeah, well, it's, in response to the question, well, is it, do you want an attorney or what is it that you want to do? He responded, yeah, well, I don't understand what you're talking about. This honorable court determined that yeah was constituted a valid invocation of rights. Therefore, the confession should not have come in. Therefore, it was reversible error. The case was reversed, went up, went back, retried. And the reason I mention that is I would point out that we conscientiously avoided any reference before the jury of any ever, the existence of any statement of accused in the form that was admitted and caused error in the first trial. We need to understand what's going on here. Officers here, this is so fresh, members of the honorable court. The officer who responded heard the fatal gunfire. This was not coming across two bodies in the canal bank and you don't know how they got there. They get a description of a particular truck. They find it, it's got the engine warm. The responding officers from outside the fence see blood in another vehicle. They later go through the fence that's unlocked conceitedly and obtain consent from the accused, from the appellant. Also, I would point out that also convicted in this case is his son, Eloy Giovanni Alcala. His case has been up and back. This honorable court affirmed his conviction, mandates issued. He's got no, his appeal is exhausted.
But counsel, you kind of glazed over this argument. I could see the state making the argument regarding what, you know, going in and getting permission and getting consent. But how about just the first step of getting past the fence? They're saying that in and of itself required a warrant.
It
how
did
do you
not
respond to that.
I would respond, Madam Justice. There's Curley v. State and many other cases that say that going through an unlocked fence is not trespass. And I would point out, there was no trespassing signs. The fence was unlocked. A officer is free to do what a politician can do, what a proselytizer, a pollster, what any member of the public can do. The difference she makes much of, well, they got permission from the other ones. The other ones were not enclosed by like this one, but going through an unlocked gate is not trespass. The courts are very clear on this. And another thing she points out is his affidavit. I would point out a couple things about that affidavit.
That was admitted over vehement objection. I respectfully submit that it was improperly objected. Mr. Morris, my colleague, took the position, you can't have it both ways. You can't offer an evidence and an affidavit and then refuse to be questioned about that affidavit. Defense said, well, yes, we can, Judge. Yes, we can. We can submit this without being subject to cross-examination. The honorable trial judge ruled their way, but I would submit that basically that was never subject to credibility testing. He was never subject to cross-examination on any of that.
But that was just at the suppression hearing, correct?
That was just for the purposes of the suppression hearing, Madam Justice. Thank you. And a couple things I would point out about this suppression issue. There's exceptions. Some of them come out under exceptions, like plain view. From outside defense, I see blood in the car. There's no need for a warrant. Search of the outside of the car doesn't even constitute a warrant. GSR, the gunshot residue, they would have found, they did not need a warrant to obtain that. That's not an intrusive examination. And many of these things they have no standing on. She has a laundry list of things that should be subject to suppression. Many of those belong to or were connected with Giovanni. For example, within that list is Giovanni's DNA sample. How does this defendant have standing to contest the DNA of his son, DNA obtained from his son? And others, like the guns that he provided at his house, have no inculpatory value at all anyway. But I'd like to start at the beginning. Her starting point is he was in custody the minute the officers walked up to the door. That is absolutely unsupported in fact and in law. Custody, for purposes of making a statement, is established when the accused is formally arrested or when his freedom of movement has been restrained to the degree which is associated with formal arrest. There was no display of weapons. Yes, they had weapons. That's what they do. They are expected to have weapons for self-protection and protection of others. They did not brandish them. There was no commands, get down on the floor, put your hands up, nothing like that. There was no restriction of movement. I would point out, Madam Justice Longoria and members of this panel, his movement was so unrestricted in that house, he's handling guns. He's handling firearms, handing guns to the officers, and it turns out later those guns were loaded. A person in custody is not allowed to handle firearms.
At what point in time was Giovanni in custody during this?
What they did, Madam Justice, is they arrived at the home. They said, is Giovanni here? They immediately took Giovanni out because they knew that Giovanni had been in a fight. At that point, they already knew he had been in a fight, and they already knew that in the car that he was driving was huge amounts of blood. So they had a greater level of suspicion initially on Giovanni than they didn't know that that the father, the appellant here, was involved at any point until the investigation developed.
And whose blood did it turn out to be? Just
which blood, Madam Justice?
In the Cadillac.
That turned out to be the victim's blood. It was also the victim's blood found on the running board or the entry step of the pickup truck with Giovanni's bloody footprint right in the middle of it. And I would point out that, back to what I was saying a moment ago, they said, well, suppression, that should have been suppressed. He had no standing to contest the suppression of a shoe that didn't even belong to him. It belonged to his son. His subjective belief, in any event, if you give his affidavit any credibility, it's not his subjective belief that matters. Well, I believed I was intimidated and I didn't believe I had a choice. That's not the standard. The standard is what would an objective person in that situation believe? There was no force. There was no, as to obtaining consent, there was no, we already have your permission, you can't deny it, nothing like that. But even if he had then been in custody, even if appellant's premise is true, the minute they showed up at his door, he was in custody, it doesn't matter. Armstrong v. State, 3550 Southwest 2nd 25, and other cases outside of the Criminal Appeals Court say very clearly, a person in custody can validly give consent. But then they say, well, why didn't they Mirandize him? There's no requirement for Miranda. Rayford v. State, and at 125 Southwest 3rd 521 out of the Court of Criminal Appeals, and many other cases say very clearly, you need not give Miranda warnings before you ask for permission to search. And I would point out on page 38 of her brief, she invites you to reverse that. She says, well, it only applies in the context of a confession, but we should extend it to apply here. Respectfully, this court should decline the invitation if for no other reason than this court is duty-bound to follow a binding precedent.
Counsel, I have a question here. Okay, let's assume we accept all those arguments, but why didn't the court, or why shouldn't the trial court have given the article, you know, what, 38.23 instruction in the charge?
May I respectfully take a drink of water?
Sure.
Thank you. I apologize to the court. It's a medical thing. Justice Hinojosa, as the court's well aware, the evidence, what happened in suppression doesn't matter when we're talking about entitlement to a 3823 instruction, because it must be evidence that's heard before the jury. That's under Madden v. State, 242 Southwest 3rd, 504. Mm-hmm. The suppression evidence, all this that happened in suppression doesn't matter. It's what did this jury hear? And the other main part is there must be a factual dispute. There was no dispute over operative facts. We do not dispute that that fence was closed or that there was a fence. We don't dispute that the gates were closed. We don't dispute, there is no dispute that the gate was unlocked. I apologize for my voice. There's no dispute of what happened, factual dispute. The jury, the 3823 instruction is to be submitted when there is a dispute regarding operative facts. What her proposed instruction said is decide whether the consent was valid or not. That's a question of law. A factual dispute might be something like, do you find from the evidence that it was coerced? Do you find from the evidence that it was obtained by deception? And because it's the role of the jury only to decide fact issues, not points of law, those defer to the court. I would point to the court of a passage from a case that this court rendered, Chubb v. State, 821 Southwest 2nd, 298. The issue is waived anyway. A charge rather than state mere abstract propositions of law and general statements of principles contained in the statutes must clearly apply the law to the very facts of the case. They didn't even get there because they did not submit an instruction that would have done that. Their instruction said you are to consider whether consent to the search of the premises was voluntarily and understandably given either orally or in writing. That's not a proper instruction. The whole claim of entitlement is in the first place waived. Secondly, there's no dispute of facts. And I would like to read a passage from Madden, Madden v. State, 242 Southwest 3rd, 504. They make this point. Here, for example, one issue is whether appellant exceeded the speed limit of 55 miles per hour through a construction site, giving Officer Lilly a reasonable suspicion to stop him. If Officer Lilly testifies that appellant did speed and appellant testified that he did not speed, this is a disputed factual issue. This disputed factual issue must be submitted to the jury. It goes on to say, though, if, however, Officer Lilly says that appellant did speed, and witness two or appellant says that he doesn't remember or doesn't know, there is no disputed fact to submit because there is no affirmative evidence of a factual conflict. Similarly, if Officer Lilly testifies that appellant did speed, but the cross-examiner grills him, isn't it true that he really did obey the speed limit? You're wrong, you're lying. There is no factual dispute unless the officer admits, yes, that is true. The cross-examiner cannot create a factual dispute for purposes of an Article 3823 instruction merely by his questions. It is only the answers that are evidence and may be created a dispute. Even the most vigorous cross-examination implying that Officer Lilly is the cretin liar, that's the everyone in our village lies, don't believe anybody, does not raise a disputed issue. There must be some affirmative evidence of, quote, did not speed, unquote, in the record before there is a disputed fact issue. Because there was such evidence in the record, the trial judge properly gave the instruction on this disputed fact. And I would point out that the Court of Criminal Appeals put it perfectly in Robinson, as the Honorable Justice Silver was touching on. Robinson v. State, 377 Southwest 3rd, 512. Where the issue raised by the evidence of trial does not involve controverted historical facts, but only proper application of the law to undisputed facts, that issue is properly left to the determination of the trial court. That is precisely what we have here. There was no factual dispute. What would the jury have been asked to consider? Ma'am, please. What would the jury have been asked to consider? Or as the Honorable Justice Silva pointed out, what facts would have been submitted for them to determine? There was no disputed facts.
To clarify, I guess It would have been on the record in the cross-examination of the officers that there were going to be any dispute of facts with regard to this, and there, yeah. There was nothing like that.
There was nothing like that, Madam Justice. One moment. I don't have the record references at my fingertips, but I can assure this honorable court that I went backward, forward, upside down, and sideways through that record. The operative facts of the status of the fence was not in dispute. It would be a different scenario if we said the gate was unlocked and appellant or some other witness said, no, they broke the lock. It would be a different case if they said, we walked through the fence, and they said, no, I saw them going over the fence. That would be a factual dispute of how they gained entry. Here, there was no factual dispute. There was nothing to be submitted to the jury.
Counsel, how about the actual fact that, you know, the number of the office, whether or not the consent that was given, the written consent, whether that was coerced or voluntary, involuntary,
They have to raise a factual dispute, not just, there was no factual dispute about the number of officers, and the reason there was no factual dispute is the officers testified, appellant chose not to. Appellant chose not to present controverting evidence. The mere, for example, if the question was posed, well, do you find from the evidence that the presence of five officers made it involuntary? That is actually a legal question. That's not a factual question. The factual question would be, one side says there was one officer who politely knocked on the door. The other side presents evidence showing that there was a full SWAT team in raid gear battering down the doorway. That would be a factual dispute.
There's no dispute about the number of officers or the ones that were in the room when he signed the consent or the words that were used during the
I'm going to say, Madam Justice, there was no
there's no record about that.
There's no record. Now, if someone said, did he say please first or second, may I please come in your house, please may I come in your house, that's a distinction without a difference. And I would point out that the contested factual issue must be affirmatively contested, not just in dispute. There was no affirmative contest to any facts in dispute. Back to the discussing the suppression further, even if the entry was improper, the later consent is not necessarily tainted. I would point this court to its opinion in Lyman v. State, 314 Southwest 3rd, 694. In Lyman, the question presented was, did a minor child have authority to grant entry to the home? Did he have authority to give them permission to enter? This court took one position, the Court of Crown Appeals took another. But that's the point being, the court laid out some factors. This court said, quote, to determine whether consent to search following the police's illegal entry onto premises is tainted by the illegal entry, we must look to the following factors. And you laid out six factors. The first one was time span. Here, there was a considerable period of time between the first entry going to touch the truck and the entry to obtain consent. Did they make observations did they find what they were looking for? Here, the observations were already made from outside the fence. They saw a truck that seems to match a description, and they see blood in a vehicle. There's no flagrant misconduct. They didn't kick the door down with raid gear. They didn't climb over the fence or rip the fence out. They merely, as anyone would be authorized to do, calmly open the gate, walk through, and went to the door and knocked politely. Their purpose was to dispel or confirm the possibility that he was involved in the offense. And I would point out, the courts are very clear. Touching that hood, if you say, well, they did it, it was illegal entry, for what purpose? There was no search of that truck. Touching the hood did not constitute a search. I would point the court to, as the Honorable Justice Silva pointed out, in Hudson v. State, the Court of Criminal Appeals considered whether taking photographs of the exterior of a vehicle on private property constitutes a search. The court said that does not. Their sister court, the Honorable First Court of Appeals out of Houston, said in Goldberg v. State, 95 Southwest 3rd, 345, the following. Applying those principles. I apologize to the Honorable Court, ma'am. Please drink water.
Take your time and use your water as you see fit.
My voice is failing me. First time ever. Applying those principles, the first court of appeals in Goldberg said this: touching the hood of the vehicle, like the taking of photographs in Hudson or the paint scrapings in Cardwell, was not a search, but was simply a physical examination of the exterior of a vehicle. But even if it did constitute a search, which it did not, it was justified, Madam Justice, Justice Longoria and members of this court, that he was going to be gone. We must bear in mind, they've got a person who has just committed a double murder, who may be on the loose. They do not know who this person is or what his intentions may be, but they, by golly, want to find out at the earliest opportunity. I would respectfully submit, if they had ripped that fence out with a backhoe to get to that truck, if that's what it took, they would have been justified. All they did was walk politely through a gate. But their purpose for entering would have been gone had that hour passed by. The testimony was very clear. The heat was not going to be there. It was going to be dissipated. We've got testimony in record, among other references, that 27 reporters record volume 2775-76 and within volume 33 at 160-161. And that would be assuming getting a warrant would take at least an hour. And that's assuming that there is a justice with authority to grant such a warrant in the middle of the night. They wanted to touch that truck to determine if there's an active shooter. I don't like the term active shooter. It implies a whole different scenario. If there is someone who's just exhibited homicidal tendencies, and he might be in this house, conceivably he may have been the shooter going to that house to do harm to the occupants. They have no idea what's going on at that point. The Goldberg court pointed out that if it was classified as a search, it was justified under exigent circumstances, and the Goldberg court said this: furthermore, the intrusion by the police by walking into the open carport and touching the vehicle was so slight that the privacy interest appellant seeks to protect is not one we believe that society would, deem reasonable. Now, moving to the facts on the gunshot rescue form, that's not even a search, or that's not even a statement. It doesn't meet the definition of a statement. He voluntarily went to the police department. The GSR's inquiries were done before he was formally interviewed. Although he was held in a place where he would have had to ask permission to leave, no one told him he couldn't. He was not in custody until after his formal interview. So Miranda doesn't apply. The requirement of Miranda doesn't apply because he was not then in custody. That's Dancy v. State. He voluntarily went, and he was never told, you are not free to leave. I'd like to touch very briefly on the question of sufficiency, if I may. The evidence is more than sufficient. The court's well aware of the standard. I won't reiterate it here. All evidence to be considered, even that evidence that was improperly admitted. Thank you, Justice. I do not mean any disrespect to the court by drinking. Circumstantial evidence alone can support a conviction. That Hooper v. State, 214 Southwest 39, Court of Criminal Appeals. Let's look at what we have here. We've got Giovanni was angry right before, yelling and screaming, I'm going to kill that dog. After the fight between him and Giovanni, he comes back, gets his dad, and they both leave in his truck. Very soon after that happens, the fatal gunshots are heard. He blacks out his truck when he returns, rather than driving with headlights, mind you, it's the middle of the night. When the officers start patrolling, he moves his truck from the curb where it could have been seen into this area where it'd be harder to spot. He's the neighborhood watch captain who typically takes great interest in the comings and goings of everybody in the neighborhood, but when his neighbor comes up and says, hey, there was gunshots down the street, did you hear? I don't know anything. I don't want to know anything. I didn't hear anything. It goes inside. The matching truck, it's still warm to the touch. When the police officers find you, this is the neighborhood watch captain. When the police officers are at his home, obviously very interested in his property, looking, spotlighting, flashlighting, he doesn't come out, hey, can I help you fellas? What can I do for you? He goes in the house, locks the door, closes the blind, and hides. But there's more than just those circumstantial things, just situational things. We've got the matching receipt. One found it, matched cash and carry, found at the scene, matched cash and carry, found in the truck. Ammunition found at the scene, matches that in the truck. Bloody shoe print found at the scene, bloody shoe print on the truck, matches his son's, is the victim's blood, and matches his son's shoe. Of the two suspects, him and his son, he's the one with GSR in his hand, offered a nonsensical explanation for that. And both he and his son were found to have a GSR gunshot residue on their clothing. They said, well, that wasn't credible. That's not a grounds to undermine a verdict, Madam Justice. Likewise, the possibility of other explanations doesn't get you there. I'll touch very briefly on issues 1 through 5, where she says we denied her an opportunity to cross-examine Ms. Officer Galaviz. I would point out that's one single ruling in a mass of over 125 pages of transcript of cross-examination. That cross-examination starts at 35 reporters record 33, goes on to page 162. One ruling in there, they say, denied their opportunity to cross-examine. And let me just remind the court how this played out. Question from Mr. Alamond, defense counsel. Now, with reference to the house, you said you all had focused your attention towards that truck. Did you even make an effort to go towards the truck, knocking and talking while the prosecutor interjects, Your Honor, objection, this is again talking, he's argumentative, he's trying to imply there was some kind of trespass that occurred, the court has ruled that it's not a trespass. Your Honor, we're going to, Ms. Goshers points out, and Your Honor, and he has ruled on this issue, Mr. Alamond comes back with, Your Honor, we would object if she has a specific objection, she needs to state that. Ms. Goshers responds argumentative. Mr. Alamond responds, not making an argumentative objection. The court then says, I'm going to sustain the objection. Honestly, I've had great difficulty even trying to wrap my head around what objection is the trial court sustaining. Both sides were objecting over each other. So I don't even know what that ruling pertains to. But if that is viewed as a ruling excluding their opportunity to present evidence, it's waived. It's waived for two reasons. One, they never made an offer of proof to complain about the exclusion of evidence, you must make a proffer. And secondly, there was, again, I went through this record meticulously, no confrontation clause complaint was raised in trial. That is waived. And I would point out to the court a quotation from Potier v. State at 68 Southwest 3rd, 657 at page 658. We hold that the exclusion of a defendant's evidence will be constitutional error only if the evidence forms such a vital portion of the case that the exclusion effectively precludes the defendant from presenting a defense. We don't have that here. Not only because it's one ruling in that massive transcript, there's other evidence about the fence. Officers Clanton, Luengo, and Leal all testified about the status of the fence at the gate. Galavis himself testified at other areas. When we look at 35 reporters' record at 56, 73, and 80, he also talks about the status of the fence. So even if they, and that one question was denied, that one question tied in to the issue of the fence status, it was brought in elsewhere, and we had stipulated. This matter, in the last few moments, this matter about the charge against Luis de la Cruz, absolutely going nowhere. He said, well, we should have been allowed to ask about the particulars of the pendency of a pending case. He testified very clearly there was no deal. There was no, I'll give you a lighter sentence or I'll dismiss or anything like that. So that there would be no relevance to any testimony from him about what the nature of that charge was. But even if we say that was error, he didn't say I saw it. He didn't say I'm a model citizen. He said I'm a ex-con, just got out of prison, used cocaine that night, told the police lies about who it was because I wanted to catch the son of a gun myself. And I told the police about lying of who I was because I didn't want to get arrested because I knew I had an outstanding warrant. This man did not embellish. This man did not present himself as anything other than who he was. And the defensive theory in no way ever challenges his truthfulness or authenticity. finally, this issue about what we've talked about, issues 1 through 5. I believe I touched on all the issues. Madam Justice, for those that we did not address this morning, I stand by the arguments set forth in our brief from previous pleadings, and I do thank the Honorable Court for indulging us the extra time this morning. and I stand ready for any question any member of this honorable court may have.
Questions? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Devenu.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yes, in response to some of, I'm going to touch on some of the things that Mr. Devenu argued under 3823, unless I'm mistaken, members of this honorable panel, I studied the record very carefully also, and my understanding, and I've cited this in my brief as to the record references, blood evidence in the Cadillac was not seen until they entered the property, until after criminal trespass occurred. So if I'm mistaken about that, I apologize to the court. I'll go back and check it one more time before I submit my supplemental brief.
Well, but counsel, there seems to be a dispute on the law on whether or not entering a gate, if it's unlocked, is trespass. You know, Mr. Devenu argued that it's the same as a mailman or a politician, I guess, going into your house and knocking on your door. That is not trespassing. Would you like to address that issue?
First of all, Your Honor, there was no evidence submitted to trial in the trial as to where, let's say, for example, the mailbox was located. Okay, I block walk for Bethel. I've done it a few times. When there is a fence, I don't go in that fence, okay? When there's a mailbox outside the fence, I'll put a flyer in there, and I can do that safely without committing criminal trespass. But very clearly, when there is a fence, there's no, it indicates by law, and I know this court is not in the business of legislating. That would be a violation of separation of powers, but specifically, the law states that when there is a fence surrounding the property, and in this case, there was a fence surrounding the property with no holes in the fence. There was gates, and there was a sliding gate. Okay, but when there is a fence, that indicates notice to the public that people are not allowed to go inside the premises of that fence. So Mr. Devenu will harp and harp on the fact that the lock was unlocked. So what? The law doesn't address that, and it doesn't require a lock to be on there. So that's how I'm addressing it, is that you just look at the face of the statute. I don't think this court is ready and
where
willing.
Where do you cite that on your, let's look at that statute. Where do you have?
It's 30.05 of the Texas Penal Code. That addresses the criminal
trespass. I assume it's in your brief.
Yes,
you,
it is.
Do you know what page it?
Bundle them nerves right now, so I'm not very graceful in.
But you're saying that it's because I believe Mr. Devenu cited a case. I didn't write it down, but you're saying that just by the plain reading of the statute of trespassing, it would clearly say that going past the gate is
criminal trespass.
And it's criminal trespass.
Right. And so what that does, Your Honor, is that there, I've also cited a case, I can't put my finger on it this very minute, that says that consent is ineffectual when criminal trespass has occurred. And I've cited the Jardines case. It's a United States Supreme Court case. In that case, there wasn't even a fence. Okay. The court held that when the officers went on to, let's say, the front porch of the house with the drug-sniffing dogs, that constituted a violation because they went up there for the purpose of gathering evidence. They didn't have a right to be there. So, I mean, if you look at it now, even though there may have been a double homicide, that doesn't throw away the Constitution. Okay, that doesn't mean that we don't have, that Mr. Alcala no longer had constitutional rights.
Counsel, was the issue of going past the fence, was that addressed in the underlying Alcala case when the son was because I have the state of that, I mean, that opinion in front of me.
I think Mr. Devenu can probably answer that question.
Madam Justice, you know, I think I'm in a better position. It's unusual, but I was the prosecutor in that case as well on appeal. No, that was not the court. The court addressed sufficiency of the evidence and then delved into the propriety of the omission of the statement and did not address this issue that we're dealing with this morning.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Justice.
Counsel, what about the fact that some of the evidence or the evidence, the blood discovered, I think the testimony was that the officers were outside of the gate and they shone the flashlight over the gate. Is that a different issue with regard to trespass?
Well, my understanding is that the blood evidence is not actually discovered until entry was made into, the criminal trespass occurred the first time. While they were in there, somebody shined their light. I don't know if it was one of the officers inside or outside. That's when the blood was found. Okay, my understanding is that was found after entry was made. It was not seen from outside the fence. I'm gonna have to go back and check that because now Mr. Deveneau, who I, you know, have great respect for, has stated it occurred, that they saw it outside the fence. But I looked and looked while I was writing my brief and I didn't see it. Also, as to the consent issue, there was evidence elicited that Mr. Officer Galaviz had his gun drawn, and he was one of the ones that approached the house during the consent process. And lastly, another important issue is that while consent was trying to, while the officers were attempting to get consent from Mr. Alcala, Giovanni, Mr. Alcala's son, was taken out in handcuffs right before his eyes, okay? And he was arrested and taken into custody. That was during the consent process. How does that, when we don't look at directly that guns were drawn and this was a SWAT team is told to get down on the floor, there can be all kinds of incidences that occur that the court can imply that consent was not voluntarily given. A gun drawn is one of them. Who's gonna say no when you have a gun drawn?
Counsel, just to go back to your prior point, looking at Mr. Deveneau's brief on page 34, he cites the record where it says from outside the fence perimeter, officers were able to see what appeared to be blood on the inside of the sedan.
Okay.
And so page 34 is where Mr. Deveneau's brief indicates that.
Does it make a record reference?
Yes, Your Honor, 33RR167 and 34RR79 and 132. So you may want to look at that because essentially if the record does reflect that they saw blood and they matched the vehicle, that would certainly give them the ability to get into the perimeter of the fence. I mean, it's still, you still have your argument about the consent to search, whether the consent, the written consent was voluntary and all that. That argument stands, but as far as them being able to enter the premises, certainly that may, you know, just to clear up the record. I mean, that'd be something I'd like for you to look at.
Yes, I'll look at that, and I'll try to clarify that if the court's okay with me maybe addressing that or correcting it in my supplemental brief, which will be hopefully due a week from this coming Friday. Is that okay with the court? Because I'm going to be out of town this
That's
weekend.
That's fine.
Okay. So I will definitely look at that, Your Honor. Well, the other issue is that blood, because the initial testimony, the initial investigation revealed a white truck. There was no evidence about a Cadillac. Okay, that Cadillac evidence didn't develop until later. That blood was found in the Cadillac, not the truck. So again, my understanding is that evidence wasn't seen until after entry was made. I do have cases cited indicating that obtaining evidence when criminal trespass has occurred is illegal. And certainly if it wasn't a search as to the evidence, the state had no problem with introducing that evidence at trial that the hood of the truck was hot, but so was the neighboring hood of the truck, okay? And one officer testified it was so hot he could hardly touch it. So, I mean, even though they're saying it wasn't a search, it was evidence and it was utilized at trial. And in closing, Your Honors, Justices, I am very grateful for the opportunity to present this argument today before you. It was my honor. And I do appreciate the week from next Friday to be able to submit a supplemental brief. Thank you.
The case will be in submission. Thank you, counselors.
Thank you.